First up, we have Mike Molesworth and Janice Denegri-Knott. I should have checked
yeah.
this.
Oh, that's
yeah,
perfect.
That's good. From Bournemouth, from the media school in Bournemouth. They're going to talk a little bit about the generality of this virtual self stuff and looking at a number of aspects of that. And you've been working with, hang on, let me check the bio, students studying media and related disciplines in the Centre for Excellence in Media Practice in Bournemouth.
Okay, so Janice and I research and teach consumer behaviour, so that's the discipline we're coming from. And therefore, it's from that perspective that we're going to give a tour of the digital virtual.
We are all probably very familiar with a range of online spaces that invite consumers to play. For example, there's Second Life, World of Warcraft, but also Facebook and eBay. You have online forums and a range of online console games. Between them, these present us with a significant development in consumer practices. So we want to first briefly deal with this consumer culture and its virtual nature. The popularity of these sites draw our attention to an aesthetic movement in consumption, and we may observe that as a consumer culture moves away from the material, that the productive apparatus and related demand factors sustaining economies reconfigure the commodity type produced and the practices that accompany them, such that markets and consumer cultures are in an iterative relationship. For Don Slater, it is a trajectory that starts with post-Fordism that has led to this dematerialization of commodities. This ongoing metamorphosis is seen by Martin Lee as a transition in production from material to experiential commodities that ensures that consumers never run out of things to want. In return, consumers have learned to place emphasis on the imaginary aspects of the consumption experience, where functional utility is either taken for granted or is irrelevant. The increase in information-intensive commodities such as software, along as commoditized cultural events, come to signal what Klein and Gilmore called in the 1990s experiential economies. And for Stephen Klein and colleagues, digital games, within which we would include the websites mentioned, rise as ideal commodity forms for such economies. So we have that economic imperatives coupled with a society that has come to rely on consumption as a source of pleasure beyond utilitarian needs has encouraged increasing emphasis on sustaining consumer desire through the gradual dematerialization or virtualization of consumption. What then of this idea of digital virtual space? In everyday lexicon, virtual reality conjures up images of computer simulations that are a stand-in for something material. However, there is some consensus regarding the potential pitfalls of creating a simple dichotomy between materiality and virtuality, which ends up making the material more akin to what is natural and the virtual no more than a copy of this. In effect, the conceptualization of the virtual as not real masks the socially constructed nature of all reality. And when consumers easily embrace the digital virtual, it perhaps reveals that the meaning and value of a thing lies not in its material form, but in its non-material but very real cultural associations. Experiential consumption muddles distinctions between the materiality of a good and its desirability. To put it another way, we may see the virtual or imagination as the main location of consumption and the material as simple one way to actualize these ideals. The digital virtual now gives us other ways. Rob Shields has further addressed the relationship between imaginary and material realities, presenting an ontological tetralogy that restates the virtual, imagination, and the material as real, as more usefully opposed to the abstract and probable as possible. Such a conceptualization then presents the digital virtual as a hybridization of the material and the virtual as imagination, what Shields therefore terms as liminal. The implication is that the digital virtual may contain the actualizing potential of the material with the idealizations of the imagination. Previously, a reliance on material actualization limited consumer desire to the actually possible, and as consumers run out of material things to desire, we see the rise of discourses related to consumer boredom. The development of simulations in the digital virtual, however, may invite an individual to buy a whole new array of exotic ideal commodities based on abstracts. The extension of what of what may be desired and actualized becomes key to the attraction of the digital virtual. The digital virtual strips away our ability to justify consumer practices by claiming material utility and opens up new opportunities for consumer pleasure and experiences. What we are only just able to see are the range of practices that these spaces sustain.
I hope you got all that. I helped to write it and I'm exhausted just listening to that. Examples are easier. So I'm going to illustrate this with some examples, hopefully. Perhaps the most straightforward aspect of the digital virtual consumption that we're talking about is the extent that commercial websites present a range of goods and services to consumers to stimulate their imagination and therefore construct their sense of self. That's our little game. We're all going to have one slide with self in on. A specific example is eBay, that dwarfs high streets and shopping malls in terms of the range of things on offer, with over 16 million items for sale at any time. Images of goods are presented in an endless procession before the would-be buyer, stimulating their imaginations as they window shop. And so compelling is the experience that there have been concerns raised about eBay addiction. Are there any here? Some guilty-looking face. As a community, although we must be careful with using that term, eBay also illustrates that this is a form of consumer culture that requires large numbers of users. Auctions are user-generated, and in this way, eBay as a business exploits its users' own labour to provide a service that it can then charge for. Another online retailer, Amazon, offers consumers a range of alternative and complementary products when a search is made, and thus also increases the number of images presented for a contemplative gaze. It also offers wish lists, so consumers may view lists of desired commodities created by others, or may even create their own. Any desired item, but not yet and possibly never afforded, can be placed in this personalised area, remaining in the possession of the individual, and providing pleasure as an item that, when or if acquired, will fulfil the wishes of the consumer. Other spaces invite more complex ownership performances. In video games, an individual may also play at purchasing commodities that represent a material equivalent. For example, in racing simulations such as Need for Speed franchise, the purchase and customising of cars is central to the game, with more expensive cars a sign of in-game success. And the Sims franchise, of course, allows players a wide range of digital virtual commodities to possess as the in-game actualisation of a perfect lifestyle. But we've hinted, if you were following, we've hinted that the digital virtual may invite more abstract fantasies, whereas material consumption, I'll say this a bit slower, can only ever actualise the probable. Some digital virtual spaces are outlets for the actualisation of the abstract. For example, in World of Warcraft, desired commodities include magic staffs, swords, armour, and even fantasy creatures. Players may hope to possess that which previously could only be experienced vicariously through text and film-based fictions. And game producers ensure that there are always new items or experiences to be strived for. In World of Warcraft, some items are only available to players that have reached the highest level. So although the goods are abstract, the structure of desire is consistent with material consumer behaviour. Players work, in the form of quests, in order to achieve the best stuff, and find themselves in a cycle of desire, acquisition, and then desire for the next thing, just like material consumption. However, this re-enchantment of labour as hero in exotic quest also points to the possibility that the digital virtual allows for the adoption of new subject positions. Individuals may assume a different gender, financial status, or profession. This may seem to be an extension of the identity work produced through shopping and enhanced through online resources. And these fantasies may include consumer behaviours that are not normally socially acceptable. Largely law-abiding citizens may become serious criminals. And they may sleep with and even murder prostitutes, or may become embroiled in dangerous police shootouts in the Grand Theft Auto series of games, for example. In World of Warcraft or Second Life, consumers may also manufacture and sell their own fantastic commodities, and so enact entrepreneurialism. Such digital virtual goods may even have material monetary value. One result of all this activity is that the term consumption itself is problematised, or rather the producerly aspects of consumption are foregrounded as a lack of material consumption becomes evident. Participants in these spaces help to produce a complex and nuanced cultural meaning. Another example may be seen on the UK Hot Deals Forum, where users compete to present the best deal by searching the high street and the web for bargains. Here there's also a blurring between the traditional roles of producer, who sells, and the consumer, who buys. Forum members present deals complete with sophisticated sales pitches. And again, the use of consumers' own labour sustains the digital virtual space. It seems the trick in this economy is to produce a business model. Microsoft completely missed this, by the way. The trick in this economy is to produce a business model where you sell consumers' own labour back to them as a shared fantasy. These practices are sustained by other markets too. Actually, Microsoft did all right with this. We see growth in sales of computer hardware and software, even Vista, and in telecommunications. We also see the movement of marketing budgets towards the sorts of digital virtual experiential freeware that we have described. The digital virtual now invites considerable innovation in terms of the way to make money from consumer fantasy. The result is the potential for both liberatory and critical discourse. The digital virtual may offer a way out of the stagnation of post-Fordism by extending the range of experience that an individual may desire. Yet this is also a marketisation of cyberspace and a continued or even accelerated commercialisation of the imagination. In the digital virtual, consumers are encouraged to have more of everything and more quickly. Beyond the exacerbation of a consumer ethic, consumers are further exploited by virtue of the labour they undertake in games, auction sites and communities by generating surplus value for the owners of capital. So far from liberating consumers from the socially constructed desire to consume, such developments may make consumption of digital virtual commodities, experiences and identities even more central to the individual's lives. So we see a consumer culture that reduces individuals to a series of media-created fantasies, endlessly enacted on the screen, and unable to actualise satisfying lives in the material world, individuals may retreat to the digital virtual as a form of compensation. That's it.
So if there's any clarification questions, we'll take them now, but in general,
I'm sure they got all of that. Yeah. I can't believe there's anything we've said that would cause any confusion to
whatsoever.
Non-consumer behaviourists.
Let's check. You're right. So let's move on. Okay, next up is Will Reader. He's at Sheffield Hallam University and he's working on a large collaboration with people at the University of Manchester and Oxford. Didn't even get a boo from Oxford. That's amazing.
No. Okay, I'm going to principally talk this time about social network sites and friendship. I'll try and be brief because I've only got 10 minutes. The origins of this research that I'm going to be talking about comes from the work by Robin Dunbar, who's the chap at Oxford that was referred to. And basically it comes from the question that he asked about what drove primate brain expansion, particularly human brain expansion. Why is the human brain so big? And to cut a long story short, he looked at a number of variables and found that the best predictor of brain size, these are various primates, this is the neocortex ratio, effectively brain size, this is group size. So the best predictor of human brain size was actually group size. And this, if you actually look at the size of the human neocortex and read across there, it predicts that the average size of a human network group is about 150. This on the right kind of shows the way that there's a kind of schematic diagram of this. Each of us, he argues, would know about 150 people. Of those 150, we'll have 50 people who are fairly close friends, people we communicate with fairly frequently. 15 close friends and then 5 people who we're very close to. And that has been supported by a fair bit of data that he's found, which I won't go into. But that is basically the origins of this. One question is, why are there these regularities? Why don't we have thousands of friends? Why don't we have 10, 20, 30, 40 close friends? One answer is that friendship costs in a number of ways. Friendship costs us in terms of the time and effort we have to invest in forming and maintaining social relationships. Friendship costs us in terms of material resources. So, for example, if we give people gifts, if we lend people things, or give people food, or whatever it happens to be, buy people drinks. It also costs in terms of cognitive resources as well. Memory for what friends particularly like. Also memories for the relationships among people. Who likes whom, who has fallen out with somebody who used to be an ex-partner of somebody. So the cognitive costs. Kind of related to that, conflict management costs. There's some research which from the University of Manchester as part of this project which suggests that as networks get bigger, and particularly as they get more diverse, these are Facebook networks, you get more conflict. And conflict might be one constraint upon network size, a desire to manage conflict. And then risk of parasitism, not a pretty obvious one that, but when you become friends with somebody, particularly in the early stages of friendship formation, you do put yourself in a somewhat vulnerable position in terms of their exploiting you. So for example, the term fair weather friends refers to somebody who you help out, and then when it comes to their turn to help you out, they kind of vanish like the mist. So there are various costs. In terms of the computer-mediated communication social network side of it, it's been pointed out that these kind of tools actually can lower the cost of communication, particularly if you compare it to face-to-face contact. And that Dunbar research with the circles was pretty much to do with face-to-face, old-style communication. It reduces the cost of communication. If you want to communicate with your friends, you can update your profile. You can upload photographs. You can tell them what you're doing. So it's very easy to let a lot of people know what you're up to. You can use multi-recipient communication. You can email your entire network, or message your entire network, or subsets of it. Very much reduces the cost of communication. And this has been suggested that this might have the effect, the kind of knock-on effect, of increasing network size. It enables us to manage greater network sizes. In fact, Robin Dunbar himself asked the question whether the development of these tools is the kind of next stage of evolution, which enables us to get ever larger groups. And Dunath and Boyd made the point that this could increase the size of our weak ties, if not our strong ties, our kind of weaker relationships. This is some data which is from a study that we did last year. It's a survey study looking at 485 participants of who were users of social network sites, principally Facebook, but also some Bebo users and MySpace users as well. The graph here, just to quickly unpack it, this is total time. This is on the x-axis. This is the amount of time somebody has used the social network site for, multiplied by how much they use it per day, essentially. So this is people who, on the right-hand side, are heavy users. Left-hand side, are quite light users. And these are simply the total number of friends on the y-axis. The curve there, what this attempts to show, is that the number of friends that a person has increases to a certain point, but on average, it starts to flatten off. So it seems that seems to be a certain constraint on the number of these are average data, but the Dunbar data was also average data. There seems to be some kind of constraint on network size, and it's interesting to reflect what that is. It doesn't seem to be just increasing ever more with the amount of time you use it. A kind of less convincing but similar-ish story can be said for close friends. Remember that Dunbar said that we have about 15 close friends. A kind of similar thing, it increases and then starts to flatten off at the end. It's not quite as persuasive as the previous one. I've actually not got the regression equations up there, but we can talk about them later. But both of these figures, the 200 and the 15, are kind of similar to what Dunbar found in face-to-face networks. It doesn't seem that we're getting more friends. So why does cost reduction not lead to an increase in number of friends? Well, one possibility is that when you reduce the cost of a signal, you reduce its value. So when you get, if you ever get these Christmas letters that people sometimes send out, which tell you what the family are doing or whatever, maybe you're too young to get those things. You're very fortunate if you don't. People tend to treat them fairly, they're not that important because it's not been individually addressed to you. Everybody sees that they've done a photocopy of the same letter and posted it out. There was no investment in it, there's no cost to the person who sent it. Therefore, people, we hypothesize, are kind of downgrading the value. It doesn't mean much to me because you didn't put any effort in to address it to me, you sent it to everybody. So as signal costs go down, value goes down too. Second point I wanted to get across is looking at face-to-face communication. Ooh, hurry up. I like this quote from Marek Cohen, who recently wrote a book on trust, where he says that an animal which is clever enough to speak seems too clever to be believed. The point of that is that it relates to the nature of language. With language, we can say anything we want, whether it's true or not. We can say, I love you when you don't mean it, or I'm happy today when I'm not. With other forms of communication, such as facial expressions, tone of voice, things like that, it's much harder to fake. You can fake through language, much harder to fake through other means, such as face-to-face contact. So this kind of predicts that face-to-face contact might be more important for building trust than language-based communication, which is the principal mode of communication for these network sites. Okay. Now, this is, again, the same data that I mentioned. 85% of all respondents from this 485 people have met every single one of their the people who are considered to be close friends face-to-face, which is quite a lot. That breaks down to 62% for MySpace. So MySpace, as you might expect, given the different nature of that site, actually people know fewer of their close friends, but still 62% of MySpace users knew everybody, all of their close friends, not all of their network, just all of the people that are just to be close. But, and this is some more recent data, but face-to-face contact is not essential. There are still people who have people who they consider to be close, but they've never met face-to-face. The modal number is two friends. So a quarter to a third of people have at least one close friend that they never met face-to-face. So one question is trust important in these relationships? You can certainly have trust without intimacy. I trust my GP, I'm not intimate with my GP. But can you have intimacy without trust? This is a slightly puzzling graph, which is brand new. I only looked at these data yesterday for the first time. We looked at the people who actually said, yes, I have got some friends who I've never met face-to-face on my preferred social network sites. Now, we asked them, do you think it takes longer to form a relationship with those people, to become close to them, to trust them, by non-face-to-face means, as it would do if you were meeting them face-to-face? What's bizarre is we're given this option, and 27% of the people who said, yes, I've got a close friend, said that you cannot trust purely online. So that's kind of rather strange, because it suggests that they've got people that they're close to, but nonetheless they don't trust. So is this intimacy without trust? As you maybe expect, given what I've just said about the importance of face-to-face contact in conveying honest signals, being truthful, people tend to believe that it takes longer to form a relationship online than it does face-to-face, which is possibly due to the narrowness of the contact. There's not as much information there to determine whether somebody genuinely likes you, genuinely finds the same things that you're interested in. These are things which are much better communicated by face-to-face interaction rather than text, because people can say anything they want by text, as we established. Right, I've got something about the self. This is my page about the self. I feel very nervous mentioning the word Irving Goffman, because I suspect the previous speakers know far more about Irving Goffman's work than me. I've just recently started to become interested in this kind of idea, but it's something that I've been aware of for a long time. The idea, when we present ourselves on these social network sites, we present ourselves for different reasons. And one of these reasons, and this is my reading of it, one of the reasons we present ourselves in particular ways is as a goal to influence and manipulate other people. We want, for example, people to be our friends, we want people to like us, or we want people to fear us, or we want people to respect us. And depending on a particular goal, we present different aspects of ourselves. There's no one true self, I completely agree with that, and which sounds quite strange coming from a positivist kind of person, which I generally am. The presentations are motivated by some goals. Now, these goals might be obvious to the person, or they might not be. And this is, although this is from sociology, and the second one, Trevor's work, is from evolutionary biology, there's a kind of similarity there, because he talks very much about self-deception. I'm just going to show you a little bit of data in a minute. The extent that we're there to present ourselves to somebody, but we're not necessarily aware that we're managing, that we're presenting ourselves in different ways, and we're not necessarily aware of what we're doing, and we tend to believe that we are sometimes more moral and more competent than we actually are. Now, this is just some data which I'll finish off with from the first study. We ask people to make judgments of their use of social network sites and other people's use. So what do you use it for, and what does an average other person use it for? If you look at the ratings here, we ask them, is your profile an accurate reflection of yourself? And they said the modal response was 7. It's a 7-point scale. 28% of them said 7, yes, strongly agree. But only the modal response of what other people is only 3. So mine is an accurate reflection, other people's isn't. I don't use social network sites to meet potential dates, 72%, but other people do. I don't use social network sites to gain status, but other people do. My friends list isn't just a way of me showing my popularity off. No, but other people do. So one interpretation, this is the kind of self-deception, possibly. There are many other interpretations, but people have certain beliefs about themselves, and the reason they have these beliefs is the better to persuade other people of their magnanimity, their morality, or their honesty, which is all the better to kind of encourage people to become your friend or whatever it is that you want to do. I'll finish off with there, and let next speaker speak. Thank you very much.
Right, next up is Ralph Schroeder from the Oxford Internet Institute. Been doing work on e-social science, various online community stuff, some work on online fan cultures around authors.
Okay, so this is going to tie in a little bit to what the previous speakers said, particularly in regards to self-presentation. So what I've been doing work on is virtual reality technologies for quite some time. And that includes both online spaces like Second Life and so on, large-scale spaces. It also includes things like cave-type technologies and head-mounted displays and all that kind of stuff. And I've been studying that for quite some time, and I'm not going to bore you with many kinds of findings that we have about that, because we do have quite a lot of findings about that. But what I thought I'd briefly talk about is how this may affect us in the future and what we might want to think about when we think about these environments. So, overview, I'm going to just give you a definition of what I mean by virtual environments, and that's, of course, arguable, but I have a definition. And then I'm going to say that this, in a way, although my definition relates to these very high-end, immersive, virtual technologies and so on, that are really there to make you feel as if you're in another place, actually it also relates to all these social networking sites and other kind of spaces like eBay, for example, that other people talk about. And then I'm just going to finish off with some questions. So what I'm going to claim, this is a bit controversial, is that these kinds of technologies could be seen as being the very most extreme forms of all the kind of media we have. I mean, if we think of television, if we think of telephones, and all these other things that make us feel as if we are elsewhere, they're all just ways that we're mediated by technology. They're all just means of making us present somewhere else. And I think the thing about these things recently, particularly apart from virtual reality technologies and so on, is that they're proliferating, so that we have all these different kinds of forms of togetherness on the mobile phone, on social networking sites, and so on. And I think that's likely to continue to be the case. And a simple point that I want to make, and this kind of relates back to what Will was saying a moment ago, is that it's not necessarily the case that we have the right understanding of those. We have a lot of things that we think about these things that are wrong. One of the things that I think relates to how we trust each other, as you were talking about, and what kind of relationships we have. Because on the whole, what we think is that face-to-face interaction, this kind of stuff with eye gaze and where you can see the person and where you have a kind of direct contact with, that's the gold standard. That's the best way of being there together. And I'm going to claim very briefly, because I've only got very much short amount of time, that that's false. Because there are things that you can do better together, even though you're at a distance. So that's claim number one. And claim number two is that the best way to be mediated is to be as realistic, to have a kind of full body, to have all the kind of sensory equipment, have a very realistic sense of the environment. I think that's also not the case. And I think in order to make that point, I'm just going to briefly define virtual environments. And my definition, Will labeled himself a positivist, I'm an empiricist. The definition here of virtual environments technology is that these are things that make you feel as though you're in another place. So you have the sensory experience of being in a place other than the one that you're physically in, and being able to interact with it. And the reason for stressing the word sensory and empiricism here is that if you don't have this definition, then discussions of the virtual tend to go all over the place. So, for example, I always have arguments with people at conferences about, I was in a text-based mud, and I really experienced somebody else there. I assume everybody knows what text-based minds are, where you kind of text chat. and the other person make me walk into a castle, and I experience that castle as being really real, well, that doesn't fit. You have to have a sense of physically being there with your eyes, your auditory equipment, your nose if possible, your haptics, and so on. So if you have that definition, then the overall point that I would make is simply that we already know where this technology is going. We can already predict what in 100 years or 500 years' time this technology is going to look like. All we have to think about, though, is that it takes two forms. And the two forms are, if we imagine ourselves now sitting here, being captured by a video camera and being in a 3D hologram together. That's one form. And if you think about that, then that form of kind of, if you like, large-scale video conferencing allows us to do certain types of things, only certain types of things, because it doesn't, for example, allow me to take the table, imagine we're sitting in a large-scale video conference, take the table and throw it at people and not hurt somebody, right? On the other hand, if we were in an environment like Second Life, we can do whatever we like. Because in that environment, I can take the table and I can program it so either that when I throw it to you, it blows your avatar to pieces, or it bounces right off your avatar. And you can't do that in video conferencing. Now, why am I stressing all these things? Because these kinds of technologies are already here. I mean, we have 3D video conferencing already. It works, and it's very powerful. And we already have these immersive environments that make us feel as good as being there. And since you, since I see that some of you don't believe me, I'm going to show it to you. this, you, I can explain this during the discussion, but this is a 3D video conferencing piece of equipment. Basically, that person that's standing in there is being captured by 3D video cameras, and they can interact with somebody else who's also in a video camera, captured by a video camera. And they can be in a captured video environment. So this is like 3D hologram. So the other, so this is just what they look like if they're captured. And you see here, for example, what this pixelated image is, just a pixelated image of the lady's skirt. So you already have these kinds of technologies. Now, this is one of the two end states that I was talking about. The other end state are these kind of computer-generated environments. And one of the things I said a moment ago is that in some of these environments, you can do things just as well as if you're there face-to-face, right? And one of the ways to make this point is that we set out to prove this when I was working in Sweden. We had one of these cave-type environments, and the guys in London we were working with had another cave-type environment, and I can explain what that is in the discussion. And we made them do lots of stuff together. And one of the things we made them do together, so this is just showing you the equipment and the kind of setup we had. And one of the things that we made them do together is a Rubik's Cube. Now, it turns out that if you want to do a Rubik's Cube, and one of you is standing in Sweden and the other one is standing in London, then you can do it just as good as if you're doing it face-to-face. And we showed this experimentally. So here are the guys doing a Rubik's Cube together, and here they are doing it face-to-face, and it's just as good in terms of the amount of time that it takes. And this is some of the other stuff we made them do together, build houses and run around and find things and so on. So this is an environment that I studied for a long time, and one of the questions that I have about Second Life is why it took so long, because these things have been around since the late 80s to some extent, and 90s. And Second Life is only the most popular one, and these things really, you know, one of the questions you can ask about them, Second Life here, is what they're good for. This is an interesting one because this has had voice technology whereby you can be a talking fish or a head and you could always speak to each other. I mean, nowadays with Skype we take this for granted, but you know, these things have been around for a while. So these are just simple points about these environments. What are these things good for? I would claim that these things that we've just seen just now are very good for spatial interaction. These computer-generated environments, these environments in which you can manipulate the space, Second Life and places like that, that's what they're good for. Video conferencing, I think, is very good for talking heads and very little else, because coming back to my example of having this whole meeting in a video conference, that's not very interesting to just capture each chair. And what we really want is just faces talking to each other and paying attention to each other. And that's really what they're good for. So we can think about these two kind of end states that we have. And just to finish off then, I think we have all these different mediated states. Places like social networking and so on are just approximations towards these end states in which we're completely immersed and in there together. Because social networking allows you nowadays to put images of yourself, have synchronous interaction with others, and so on. So these are kind of approximations towards that. And some people even use virtual worlds and racing games and so on their mobile phones. All these are kind of approximations. And I would say again that just these two end states exist, and some of them are better for spatial interaction, some of them are better for person-to-person interaction, some of them are better for small groups, others are better for large groups, but there really isn't much more to it than that. So, my outlook is that the technology is fairly straightforward and is predictable. We can already see where this is going. People will adapt to these technologies. All these kinds of technologies will in the end come together so that, for example, you will not necessarily be in an immersive environment on the one hand and a mobile phone on the other, but you will be available through these all these different modalities, and you and the other people that you're connected with in a network of friends will simply choose which modality you're interacting with. And finally then, just to repeat these main arguments that I've made, face-to-face is not the gold standard. We do, in fact, on some occasions, and this is where maybe where I take issue with you, Will, that sometimes you can get people to know people better and trust them more online. And you know, maybe we can have that discussion. So I would simply say we have all these different states of mediated togetherness. We have only two end states to look forward to in the future. And I think one of the things that I come across is that technologists typically want to build more realistic technologies, better technologies. Social scientists just study the things, and that's my privilege to have done. But I think in the end, what we really want to think about is, and this comes back to your presentation, you know, what kind of mediated togetherness do we want in society? I think that's, in the end, the most important question. And that we have various forms for that, but some are much more pleasant, enjoyable, enriching. Others are much more silly and not enriching, whatever the opposite of that is. So I leave it there.
Magic. Right, should we do a round of applause for the speakers?